Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 337. In this episode, we're continuing our journey through the fall of Numenor by examining Numenor's return to Middle-earth in the year 600 of the Second Age, led by the great sea captain Veantur. Before we get started, I'd like to give a double up air five to our amazing fellowship. Stick 'em up. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. Very nice. That gets a 2 thumbs up. Double up, 2 thumbs up. Also, a shout out to those celebrating their fellowship anniversary in April and May of 2023. Jonathan D., Julia, Katie P., Rebecca R., Ty M., John H., Michael W., and Malcolm C. Thank you all so much for sticking with us over the last year. Join the Fellowship of the Road by visiting patreon.com/TolkienRoad. When you join the Fellowship of the Road, it helps us to keep on evering on and land you some cool perks along the way. Learn more at patreon.com/TolkienRoad. YouTube, hit that like button, don't forget to subscribe, and let us know what's on your mind in the comments below. All right. So, in the year 600 of the Second Age, the great sea captain Veantur led the first Numenorean voyage back to Middle-earth. It would be the first of many such voyages for the Numenoreans. Thus, the year 600 serves as something of a passing of Numenor from its youth to its adulthood. And perhaps it is the beginning of the mission Numenor was created to fulfill. So, in Lord of the Rings, Appendix B, the Tale of Years for the Second Age, we find in the year 600, the first ships of the Numenoreans appear off the coasts. And again, this timeline in Appendix B is, you know, really the outline that the Fall of Numenor is using for gathering all of these disparate texts and putting them all in one place concerning Numenor. So, let's go through this particular chapter of the Fall of Numenor, and let's discuss the different readings that are collected here. So the first passage has to do with Numenor, the sea, and the band of the Valar, and it comes from Akalabeth. So the Numenoreans became a sea people, right? They're an isolated people on this island. They're brought to this island. They live there for several hundred years without really leaving the island at all. You know, they're not able to journey into the west. We talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But their hearts are drawn back to the east, right? Their hearts are drawn to the sea, right? And their hearts are drawn back to the east. So they became a sea people, the greatest of all, it says. They're forbidden to sail to the Blessed Realm. Give me one moment here, just adjusting something on my screen. All right. They're forbidden to sail to the Blessed Realm. Manwë did not want them to become enamored of immortality. Compare that with the Ringwraiths, once kings of men, who sought immortality through fealty to Sauron. All right. So, you know, really all the way going back to the story of Numenor, there's this theme of man and his longing for immortality and what the consequences of that are. Now, you know, we have this interesting juxtaposition from the very beginning of the Legendarium of the elves, who are immortal beings, but whose fate is bound to this world. And men, who are not immortal beings, but live in this world, yet their fate is elsewhere, right? Their fate is drawn elsewhere. So they're banned, right? They live on this island that's, you know, within dim sight of the Blessed Realm, so much closer to the Blessed Realm than any other men, but they are not permitted to go any further towards the Blessed Realm than that, right? They're certainly not permitted to go all the way to the Undying Lands, and they're not really permitted to even journey towards them, right? So that's what's called the ban, right? The ban of Manwë, okay? And you know, the logic here is not that Manwë was trying to be like a jerk to them and be like, oh, yo, you can't have this, right? I'm holding it back from you, nananabubu, right? Like, it wasn't any of that. It was more of Manwë's recognition that that men, their fate belonged to Ilúvatar, right? And he was not at liberty. Manwë was not at liberty to change that fate, and certainly not to draw them to the Blessed Realm, to the Undying Lands, where they would, you know, it's really questionable of whether it would be increase their joy to any degree. So, in a way, you can think of the story of Numenor as this sort of speculative fiction on what it would mean for men to have much longer lives, right, on this world, right, but not yet achieve immortality, okay? it's this whole tension of being mortal versus immortal in this world, and which one is really a blessing and which one is really a curse, or is it a mixture of both? And I think the story of the elves kind of bears out that maybe there's a little bit more curse with that blessing than we might realize, that blessing of immortality than we realize. And the, you know, the reasons for that are very deep. They go, we've talked a lot about them on past episodes of the Tolkien Road. So I encourage you to go and just check out some of those other past episodes, you know, where maybe we talk about the burden of the elves as well and what they felt, you know, when they realized that their fate was bound to this world, right? Their fate was bound to this world. All right. The second passage deals with, you know, gets a little more specific on what was happening with this journey back to Numenor, or back to Middle-earth. It deals with Veantur, who first achieved the voyage back to Middle-earth. And this passage is from Unfinished Tales. We learn about Veantur. We don't really know what his lineage is or anything like that. We do know that he is, that his name means Sea Lord. It's Quenya for Sea Lord, Veantur. And his ship is called the Entulese, right, which is the return in Quenya. And he returns on this, on the Entulese, to Mithland, or the Grey Havens. And seafaring becomes the chief enterprise of Numenorean manhood, right? So if you want to really prove yourself as a true Numenorean man, then you're going to be, you know, you're going to be a seafarer, right? You're going to live the life at sea. And we start to, we'll see that play out big time in the upcoming chapters when we start to consider the story of Aldarion and Orendis, right? Or the mariner's wife. So those have to do a lot and really show us in kind of like full-on story fashion what that tension was like for the Numenoreans of being so drawn to the sea, yet, you know, their lives were back there in Numenor. The third passage has to deal with taking pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth, and this also comes from Akalabeth. Actually, before I dive in there, I almost skipped over something I wanted to dwell on a little more. And this is that regarding their journey eastward, go back from the first passage from Akalabeth. So let me read this. Thus it was that because of the ban of the Valar, the voyages of the Dunedain in those days went ever eastward and not westward. From the darkness of the north to the heats of the south, and beyond the south to the nether darkness. And they came even into the inner seas and sailed about Middle-earth and glimpsed from their high prows the gates of morning in the east. So they really did a lot of voyaging, right? You know, this is kind of a big picture of the sorts of voyages they did. But it wasn't just back to the coasts, you know, that we might like to the Grey Havens. It was, you know, they really, like, they went down into the far south where really none of Tolkien's maps cover, except for maybe, you know, maybe some obscure ones. But they went down there and even journeyed all the way over into the east, way far into the east, like the other far coast, again, that we don't really have many, if any, maps for of Middle Earth. And so they really covered a great, great portion of the world of Arda with their voyages into the east. You know, this is just one of those passages, again, that you just wish, man, I wish Tolkien had spent time expanding on these stories of Numenor, you know, more. It would have been just been great to get more stories like Aldarion and Orendis, which were maybe a little more focused in on different aspects of Numenor's history and the voyage they could go to there. But it also, you know, it makes me think that, you know, I've shared with you guys in the past that I wasn't really a fan of the first season of The Rings of Power. It fell short in a number of ways for me. And as I've thought about that a lot more, I think to myself that it has a lot to do with the notion that I think they bit off more than they could chew initially. You know, it's like, would they have been better served by trying to do a show centered around stuff that was really, really very unknown and in a much shorter period of time, instead of trying to take all these things from different aspects of a 3,000-year history and kind of cram them into one story? You know, that's really neither here nor there for the purposes of this episode, but it does make me wonder, you know, if it's a better approach maybe to start with telling smaller scale stories and expand out from there. So, well, that's that passage. It's interesting to consider all these different voyages that Numenoreans may have been on and their great, you know, the great feats they may have had as seafarers. But we'll move on. We'll move on back to passage 3, and where we consider taking pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth. So yes, they took pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth. I'm going to read this passage, snippet from this passage. And the Dúnedain came at times to the shores of the great lands, and they took pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth. And the lords of Numenor set foot again upon the western shores in the dark years of men, and none yet dared to withstand them. For most of the men of that age that sat under the shadow were now grown weak and fearful. All right. So they, you know, they took pity on Middle-earth, right? They've been gone for a while. You know, the elves at this time are not so much concerned about, you know, taking care of all of the rest of Middle-earth, but they're more kind of concerned in the second, you know, Tolkien talks some about this in various letters. He talks about how the elves of the Second Age, they start to be more concerned with like preservation, like just preserving what they can in the kind of these little small enclaves. And we see that again, really, in the Third Age as well. But the Numenoreans return to Middle-earth, and they take pity on all of it. And a large part of this is because they see their lost brethren, right? They see their long-lost cousins back here in Middle-earth, these men who were really slaves, servants of Sauron, servants of of Morgoth, servants of the Shadow in the First Age, and they take pity upon them because, you know, they're kind of scattered at this point, but they still live under fear of the Shadow, right? They still are just living lives of kind of, you know, with no greater purpose to them. And so they take pity upon them. And, you know, I see in this sort of the first notes of the mission of Numenor, right? You know, this mission of Numenor is nothing, is not something that Tolkien ever like comes right out and says, like, you know, they had this mission to do this thing. But as I've read more and more about Numenor, and I've read everything that Tolkien has had to say about Numenor, I've really become convinced that the mission of Numenor, the reason they were put there in the first place, was not just so they could live on this, you know, beautiful paradise island and just kind of hang out there for their mortal existence. Their reason for being there was to grow strong, to come back and help their brethren who were still living under the shadow, right? And, you know, I think there's so much truth in that for our own lives, right? When we're given any sorts of blessing, is it really just about us, or is it about the ability to help others, right? For to become part of that grace, that love that's flowing into the world from God, right? From Iluvatar, right? To be channels of that flowing out to everyone else, right? You know, I think as I've lived my life, I've discerned that the blessings we receive are more about that than they are about, you know, just kind of taking advantage of them for ourselves, right? So they take pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth, and that's the spirit in which they set foot upon the lands of Middle-earth that are under the shadow, you know, for the first time in the year 600. Okay, so passage 4, the Numenoreans came unarmed or in peace in the early years, and this is from Unfinished Tales. Yeah, Numenor came in peace. They did not come to conquer or plunder. So what form did their pity take when it came to the settlements of men? Well, their pity took this form. It was indeed the Numenoreans' grievance when the shadow crept along the coasts and men whom they had befriended became afraid or hostile, that iron was used against them by those to whom they had revealed it. So, you know, they're helping out men by kind of showing them different things that they can use to better their lives, but eventually it's turned upon them, right? The very iron that they had introduced these men to is turned upon them by those to whom they had revealed it. And it goes on here, and in an earlier passage at this reference, it is noted, in later days in the wars upon Middle-earth, it was the bows of the Numenoreans that were most greatly feared. The men of the sea, it was said, send before them a great cloud as a rain turned to serpents, or a black hail tipped with steel. And in those days, the great cohorts of the king's archers used bows made of hollow steel with black feathered arrows a full ell long from point to notch. So, you know, they come here, they come in peace, they come without weapons, seeking to take pity. It says the only weapons they really had are the axes and bows aboard for the felling of timber and the hunting for food upon wild shores owned by no man. They did not bear these when they sought out the men of the lands, right? So they did not come and to conquer. They did not come and say, oh, here's some people we could take advantage of. No, they came, you know, and the only things they had that could be used as weapons were actually tools, right? Axes for the felling of trees, right? They're sailing these ships across the sea. They're probably going to need to make repairs, maybe even build more ships when they get to Middle-earth. And so they have their axes in order to do that, maybe to build temporary shelters and that sort of thing. And then they also bring bows for hunting so that they can sustain themselves, right? But, and it says this important note, right? They only did this, on lands that were owned by no other man, right? So they weren't going and like invading other people's lands and taking over those lands. But what a grievous thing that these men that they go there and they try to help are the ones who really strike the first blow against them. But we do learn here this important note that the Numenoreans were pretty amazing archers, right? That they had this, you know, kind of incredible skill of archery. You know, we've seen that depicted in various places. So the fifth passage here is a little bit of a longer one, and it concerns the meeting of Numenor and Eriador, right? The men of Eriador, which Eriador being the region of Middle Earth that is, you know, kind of where you might think of the hobbits living, right? The region of the Shire, but the larger region of all of that. Okay. So the northern part of Middle Earth of the Third Age. So this passage comes from Unfinished Tales. So Numenor initially gained their friendship, the friendship of Gil-galad, and eventually an alliance, right? So Gil-galad being the High King of the Noldor at this time, Gil-galad of the Grey Havens, and they eventually form an alliance with him, right? Gil-galad, by this point, even early on, is aware that that the shadow is growing again. They don't know exactly who is who the shadow is or who's responsible for the growth of the shadow, but they know it's growing again. And so he forms this alliance with Numenor. But when the Numenoreans come, news spreads swiftly among the men of Eriador. They sent messages to Gil-galad asking leave to meet the shipmen who had returned from death in the depths of the sea. Right. So for these men, it was like, you know, these men of Eriador, it was like, it was almost miraculous that these people had come from the sea because, you know, you kind of think about it, right? The voyage of the Numenoreans to Numenor back at the beginning of the Second Age, you know, was really completed, you know, well before the year 100 of the Second Age. And here we are in the year 500, you know, 600 of the Second Age, right? When Vaontur first arrives at the Grey Havens. Well, that's 500 years, right? 500 years. And you think about 500 years ago for us, right? 500 years ago for us, when was that? Well, that was just after Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? You know, that was that is a long time ago for us, right? That is so far back that I don't even know who my ancestors were at that time, right? I don't even know their names. I have no idea, you know, what they did with their lives, where they lived, anything like that. I mean, most of us probably don't, right? Very few of us can probably trace, you know, our stories. Even in the modern age where we have so many records, we don't really have, you know, that level. You'd have to do a lot of pretty serious research to figure that out. So this is all very dim history. And, you know, again, we're talking about people who are pretty much uncivilized at this point anyway, with the men of Eriador. So, you know, this was a mythical thing for them at this point. You know, they probably, maybe they had heard stories about the, you know, these men who were their cousins and who had lived in Beleriand, you know, and they really didn't know much about them anyway. They had made this voyage across the sea, but it's like, did they really make it? Or is that just some story that said, well, think about this, right? This is like legend coming alive for these men, right? It's like, you know, just imagine if, like, you know, men arrived all of a sudden and it was like, hey, we're from the lost city of Atlantis, right? For us, right? You're just like, what? Like, you can't be serious. You're lying, right? This, it's too much. It's almost too much for the mortal mind to behold. This would have been, you know, the stories passed down from generations, just kind of shrouded in that mist of legend and of myth. But here it is coming alive. You know, this is one of those, this theme of like myth and legend coming alive is one of those themes that I think is one of the like subtle themes that makes The Lord of the Rings such a powerful story. You see it reiterated, you know, in numerous different locations. It starts all the way at the beginning in A Long Expected Party, the first chapter of Lord of the Rings, you know, when some of the hobbits are like, you know, at the Green Dragon talking about, you know, the stories they hear of like legends coming alive and this sort of thing. And they're going to see it. Many of them will see it in their own adventures throughout that story. You know, we hear this and, you know, the same thing of kind of like the legend of the Ents, and it's like, wow, they really do exist. Okay. You know, these sorts of stories, this whole theme of legends coming alive, things that you didn't really think were real, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, they're alive. It's real. Okay. So that's the sense of the men of Eriador here, is they're like, I can't believe that we're seeing these men, and they're great men, right? You know, we know that Numenoreans were taller than the average man. They must have been very, they lived longer, right? You know, we can only imagine how the men of Eriador, when they saw the Numenoreans, were just, it was almost shocking. It was almost shocking in a way. Well, I'm going to read this passage about the first meeting of Numenor and the men of Eriador, because I think this is pretty interesting. Thus it came about... share this with you guys. Thus it came about that there was a meeting between them on the Tower Hills, And to that meeting with the Numenoreans came 12 men only out of Eriador, men of high heart and courage. For most of their people feared that the newcomers were perilous spirits of the dead. But when they looked on the shipmen, but when they looked on the shipmen, fear left them. Though for a while they stood silent in awe, for mighty as they were themselves accounted among their kin, the shipmen resembled rather elvish lords than mortal men in bearing and apparel. Nonetheless, they felt no doubt of their ancient kinship. And likewise, the shipmen looked with glad surprise upon the men of Middle-earth, for it had been believed in Numenor that the men left behind were descended from the evil men who, in the last days of the war against Morgoth, had been summoned by him out of the east. But now they looked upon faces free from the shadow, and men who could have walked in Numenor and not been thought aliens, save in their clothes and their arms. Then suddenly, after the silence, both the Numenoreans and the men of Eriador spoke words of welcome and greeting in their own tongues, as if addressing friends and kinsmen after a long parting. At first they were disappointed, for neither side could understand the other. But when they mingled in friendship, they found that they shared very many words still clearly recognizable, and others that could be understood with attention, and they were able to converse haltingly about simple matters. So, this is a really cool scene. One of those that, I would have loved to see adapted maybe in the Rings of Power in sort of flashback form. But, you know, we see there the Numenoreans, like in bearing and apparel, they looked more like elves, right, to the men of Eriador than their kinsmen, but they knew they were kinsmen at the same time. And it was joy to the Numenoreans to see that there were men who were relatable, that they could relate to. And it's kind of a fun scene to think about, like, you know, they're here trying to communicate with one another, and it's kind of haltingly, but, you know, they're kind of communicating in grunts and that kind of thing. But they're able to figure it out and kind of form this bond. And this scene does remind me of when Finrod meets the men for the first time in Beleriand, right? And it's kind of like this like, oh, you know, we heard you existed, but we've never actually seen you with our own eyes. So really interesting scene here. So coming among the men of Middle-earth, the Numenoreans taught them many things. So what did they teach them? Well, first it says they taught them language. Language they taught them, for the tongues of the men of Middle-earth, save in the old lands of the Edain, were fallen into brutishness, and they cried like harsh birds or snarled like savage beasts. All right. So, of course, for Tolkien, first thing they're going to teach him is language, right? Tolkien being the linguist that he was. This is probably the most important thing that he could. Now, that's a footnote, interestingly enough, from the Peoples of Middle-earth, volume 12 of the History of Middle-earth. So, you know, great things in those later volumes of great little obscure passages in those later volumes of the History of Middle-earth. This is one of those things that just, like, you know, shows what a service Brian Sibley did by giving us this book. It also says, corn and wine they bought, and they instructed men in the sowing of seed and the grinding of grain, in the hewing of wood and the shaping of stone, and the ordering of their life, such as it might be in the lands of swift death and little bliss. So agriculture, woodworking, stone shaping, the right ordering of their lives. And, you know, this is really like they helped them to civilize, right? They helped them to maybe cast off, like, sort of the brutish ways, right, of earlier, of previous living. And, you know, there's a lot of pushback on the idea of civilization in our day and age, but it's, you know, it's really just this simple idea of, like, you know, being able to flourish, live longer lives, live better quality lives, more people survive for longer, right? Infant mortality goes down, right? All of these things, right, are products of the right ordering of your life, right? I mean, that's a question we should all be concerned with, is the right ordering of our lives. Do we want to live, you know, lives of brutishness, disordered, chaotic, or do we want to live lives of right order that harmonizes with our nature as human beings? You know, that should be what we seek, right? I mean, what other choice is there? It's chaos, right? It's a strange sentiment, you know, to reject the right ordering of one's life. So that's what they teach them. That's what the Numenoreans, kind of in a nutshell, teach the men of Eriador and the other men that come to them of Middle-earth. And it helps them to live a life of comfort and relief from the shadow, right? To reject the shadow, right? The shadow is not just this thing that hovers over, but it's this thing that would infect their lives. It's kind of like once you let it in, it infects every aspect of your life. But if you can order your life correctly, if you can repent of the ways of the shadow and turn away from it, right? Then you're able to order your life according to the light, right? According to the true light, and you're able to journey towards that and live that out. So they revered the Numenoreans and longed for their return when they left, right? Just imagine that, right? So the Numenoreans don't stick around. They don't really they don't create colonies here at first. They're not there to like kind of assert their presence and dominate. They're just there to help. They're there to help their brethren and their cousins, right? It's this beautiful image of, I think, what true like missionary work looks like. Okay, it's not this work that, you know, seeks to impose and colonize, but it seeks to lift people up, right? It seeks to lift people up out of ways that are not properly ordered and lift them up into ways that are properly ordered. I love this vision, and it's important that we emphasize this, that Numenor came at first not in a spirit of conquest, of domination, but in a spirit of mission, of help, of aid, right? Of wanting to help the people that they found. Because they have been given gifts. They've been given such a blessing, right? They've been given such a blessing. And this kind of gets back to the whole idea that I've discerned in reading all these stories of Numenor, that, you know, I believe that with Numenor's connection to Iluvatar through the Metal Tarma, right? This sort of very basic revealed religion that they had, that they were going back to Middle Earth to lift the people of Numenor, of Eriador, of Middle Earth up, and eventually to introduce them to the ways of Iluvatar, right? Because that's the ultimate thing, right? If you can order your life towards the heavens, towards God Himself, then you can order then you're ordered properly, right? Then everything else begins to fall into place, right? So, you know, I think there's a strong case to be made that was the mission of Numenor ultimately, right? Was to make known the name of Iluvatar among their brethren. But that involves more than just preaching it. That involves really lifting people up out of the brutish lives under the shadow that they had been living. So the last aspect of this chapter has to do with Sauron. All right. So Sauron, again, as we discussed a few episodes ago, is starting to assert his presence again. He looked with hatred on the Eldar, and he feared the men of Numenor who came back at whiles in their ships to the shores of Middle-earth. But for long he dissembled his mind and concealed the dark designs that he shaped in his heart. So, you know, Sauron is, he's playing the long game, right? He's not trying to, come out and attack too quickly. And he's even maybe not even giving off that he wants to, right? But he is harboring this resentment, this hatred towards elves and men, especially the men of Numenor, in his heart. And there's this interesting footnote from Unfinished Tales where Christopher Tolkien writes, "In an isolated and undateable note, it is said that although the name Sauron is used earlier than this in the Tale of Years, his name, implying identity with the great lieutenant of Morgoth in the Silmarillion, was not actually known until about the year 1600 of the Second Age, the time of the forging of the One Ring. The mysterious power of hostility to elves and Edain was perceived soon after the year 500, and among the Numenoreans first by Aldarion towards the end of the 8th century, but it had no known center." So, they know that someone is operating, but they don't know who it is until the year 1600 of the Second Age, right? So about halfway through the Second Age, they figure out, oh, this is Sauron, right? This is Morgoth's right-hand man. He's back, right? He's back and he's doing evil. All right. So that is year 600, the return of Numenor to Middle-earth via sea voyage. Let's talk about a couple of images, pencil sketches in this chapter. So the beginning, we have this image of a city white shining on a distant shore and a great harbor and a tower. So this would be the image of Tol Eressëa, right? That you could glimpse dimly on a clear day from the west coast or the Menal Tarma of Numenor, right? So wonderful sketch there. And then we have this sketch at the end of a figure who maybe he looks to be at sea, has a long hair and a beard, looks like seagulls in the background. My guess is this is supposed to be Vaon Tur. I would just question whether he should have a beard because Numenoreans didn't normally, but maybe he is much older, and at that point I believe Numenoreans would start growing beards, very later on in life. But, my thing about Numenoreans with beards, right? Aragorn, all those folks shouldn't have beards. Shouldn't have beards, especially when they're younger. All right. So, good stuff. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed this chapter, learning about the return of Numenor to Middle-earth and discussing what their mission might have been, right, in these early times. And, you know, things are starting to kind of slowly pick up in the story, and the action is just going to be increasing as we go further into the history of the Second Age. So stay tuned. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. And, hey, let's talk about it in the comments below. Did I leave anything out? Any interesting notes you wanted to emphasize? Let me know in the comments below. All right, well, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or the platform of your choice. If you are a 5-star fan of The Tolkien Road, you can really help us out by heading over to iTunes or your preferred source for the show and dropping us a rating and review. When you do that, it helps get the word out about The Tolkien Road, which helps us to keep on evering on. All right, well, thank you to everybody. Thank you to all of our everybody for watching and listening. Especially thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: John R., Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Jacob Lockham, John H., Melkor27, KG, Emilio P., Jonathan D., Mike M., Robert H., Paul D., Julia, Wordy, Joe Bagelman, Richard K., Matt R., Matthew W., Garrett P., Chris K., John W., Eugene D., Chris B., Daniel S., Seb M., Shayna Supreme, Corey C., Ms. Anonymous, Andrew T., Redhawk, Shannon S., Brian O., Zeke F., James L., Chris L., Azia V., Ish of the Hammer, Teresa C., David of Pints with Jack, and Eric B. All right. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much, Fellowship. Truly appreciate you. I think I forgot to mention executive producers at the very beginning, so I'll go ahead and give them another shout-out. John R., Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Jacob Lockham, John H., Melkor27, and KG. Thanks especially to you guys, executive producers. Sorry I forgot to mention you all at the beginning. And thanks to everybody for watching and or listening. We will talk at you next time. Bye-bye.